So there's this, there's a sutta, it's called Viranja, Anguttara Nikaya 8.11. The Buddha is hanging out in a place called Viranja at the foot of Naleru's neem tree, and a Brahmin shows up and says, and kind of accuses the Buddha of being rude to elders. He says this, I've heard, Master Gotama, the ascetic Gotama does not pay homage to Brahmins who are old, aged, burdened with years, advanced in life, come to their last stage, nor does he stand up for them or offer them a seat. In other words, he says to the Buddha is rude to elders, you know, in a culture that really respects elders, and they're Brahmin elders, so they're high caste elders, very respected elders in the community. Why don't you respect them? And the Buddha says, this is indeed true, for Master Gotama does not do that. The Brahmin says, I've heard, Gotama, that you don't do this. And then he says, and I see that it's true that you don't do this. And he says, this is not proper, Master Gotama. So he's not a believer. He's accusing the Buddha of being rude. The Buddha says, Brahmin in this world, with its devas, Mara and Brahma, and this population with its ascetics and Brahmins, its devas and humans, I do not see one to whom I should pay homage, or for whom I should stand up or offer a seat. For if the Tathagata should pay homage to anyone, or stand up for them or offer them a seat, that person's head would split open. So, you know, Buddhas are so extraordinary that it would actually be improper for them to pay homage to someone else. And then the Buddha says, then they have a really cool argument. The Brahmin accuses the Buddha of all these things, and then the Buddha flips them. So the Brahmin says, Master Gotama lacks taste. And the Buddha says, there is a way in which one could rightly say of me, the ascetic Gotama lacks taste, that Tathagata has abandoned taste for forms, sounds, smells, tastes, and tactile objects. Right, so he flips the taste thing. He makes a pun out of it, and makes it into a teaching. And then he says, "So it is in this way that one could rightly say of me, the ascetic Gotama lacks taste. But you did not speak with reference to this." Like he gets it that he's twisting it. And they do eight of these. Master Gotama is not convivial. That's true, Brahman. The Tathagata has abandoned conviviality with forms, sounds, odors, tastes, and tactile objects. Number three, Master Gotama is a proponent of non-doing. That's an insult to this Brahmin. And there is, Brahmin, a way that one could say this. For I assert the non-doing of bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct. So he turns it in the direction of sila. Master Gotama is an annihilationist. Oh, there is one way you could say this of me. For I assert the annihilation of lust, hatred, and delusion. The defilements. Master Gotama is a repeller. There is a way you could say of this, for I am repelled by bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct. Master Gotama is an abolitionist. Well, yes, I teach the Dhamma for the abolition of lust, hatred, and delusion. Number seven, Master Gotama is a tormentor. There is a way in where all of these are sort of odd translations, by the way. We could go back to the Pali to say what exactly they're translations of. But there is a way that one could say of me, the ascetic is a tormentor. I assert that bad, unwholesome qualities, bodily, verbal, and mental misconduct are to be burned up, to be abandoned, to be tormented. And then the last one, Master Gotama is retiring. I don't like that translation, but retiring, it's too vague. But I say that someone is retiring when they have abandoned the production of renewed existence, the future bed of the womb, when they have cut it off at the root. And there is an alternate translation of this that says where the Brahmin says Master Gotama is an abortionist, and that's a little charged in the current environment, so I can't quite hang with it, but it's actually more accurate to what the Brahmin is saying, which is that, you know, the Buddha is, you know, cutting off birth. In other words, is not in favor of birth. And the Buddha says, well, that's true, man. You know, I have abandoned future existence. And then the Buddha gives this simile saying, you know, if there's a whole clutch of eggs, like chicken eggs, and one of them breaks out of the shell first, would you call that one the eldest? And the Brahmin says, yes, you would. And the Buddha says, because I've broken out of the shell of ignorance first in the world, I am to be called the eldest. I am the eldest in the world and the best in the world, or the first in the world. And so, and then he tells the Brahmin his enlightenment story. He describes working through the meditative absorptions of the jhanas, and then the classic three awakening experiences of remembering his past lives, seeing how karma operates, how beings are reborn in accordance with their actions, and then the uprooting of the defilements. And so at the end of it, the Brahmin is so impressed, he goes for refuge, becomes a disciple. So the Buddha, besides that it's a fun story where they do this verbal sparring, the Buddha does this beautiful, has this beautiful line, I am the eldest in the world. And I reflected a little bit about it in the writing today. And I'm not going to go into that part as much. It's interesting, the simile of the eggs and the eldest piece. But part of what it is pointing to is the mysterious relationship of liberation or full awakening or enlightenment or the attainment of nibbana to future rebirth, right? And so, you know, central to the whole system is the narrative. I'll start with it being a narrative, because you can take it in a mythic way, you could take it in a literal way, you can take it as a kind of psychological metaphor. So it's a narrative that can be used in a bunch of ways, the narrative of rebirth, where the Buddha says, you know, once my mind was purified, malleable, able to be directed, I directed it to the knowledge of past births. And this is a stock phrase. I directed it to the knowledge of the recollection of past abodes. And the word we use for past births in this passage can also be translated past homes or past abodes, places that I lived. And that in itself is interesting, especially if you've moved around a lot. You could do a metaphor where you, or sorry, you could do a meditation, I mean, where you bring your attention to each of your past previous homes. Here's where I lived. And he says, you know, one birth, two births, three, four, five, 10, 20, 30, 40, 50, 100, 1,000, 100,000, many eons of world disillusion and evolution. There I was so named, of such a clan, with such an appearance, such was my food, such my experience of pleasure and pain, such my lifespan, such is how I died, and such is where I was reborn. And so, you know, you could think back to your previous homes. Say, oh, before I lived here, I lived, you know, over more in southern Sonoma County in the Laguna. It was much more spacious. You know, there were wild turkeys. There aren't any over here. We ate slightly different food because we lived in a different neighborhood, a different community. People called me by a different nickname. So there was I named this, you know. But I could think all the way back, you know, here's how it was when I was living in North Oakland. And here's how it was living in Berkeley. And here's how it was living in Hayes Valley in San Francisco. And here's how it was living in the Mission in San Francisco. I'm just kind of going backwards, you know. And I could go all the way back to, you know, here's how it was living, you know, in Livermore in the early 70s. And here, you know, and this becomes the reflection on past lives. And the idea being that when the mind is profoundly clear and penetrating, able to remember in a very detailed way the past, one is actually able to remember past the border between this life and the last life, which in the Theravada system, just to say, is immediate. There's not a long bardo the way there is in the Tibetan system. In the Theravadan system, it's one mind moment, boom. And that you can meditate your way back to that moment and then kind of flip-flop back and forth. You could be, oh, here's how it felt right before I died in the last life, and here's how it felt immediately after I arrived in this life, was conceived in this life. There's not a technical definition for exactly where that exists in terms of conception, but it's basically the being arriving in the womb. And so you can think of it as conception. So the process by which one does this is using mindfulness. Mindfulness, the term sati, means memory. One of the things that it points to is the ability to remember things in detail that happened long ago. That's a literal quote from the texts. The Buddha says one has developed one's mindfulness to such an extent that one can remember in detail what was done and said long ago. And so that folds into this practice of remembering past lives. And so having remembered past lives, the second of the great insights the Buddha has on the night of his awakening is seeing with clairvoyance, with the divine eye, the texts say, which is purified, surpasses the human, seeing how beings pass on and reappear in accordance with their actions. So this is a vision then, not just of one's own stream of lifetimes, but of how the stream of lifetime works. And he does it by getting the data, not just of his own life, but looking at others. So this takes clairvoyance. You see others passing away and reappearing in accordance with their actions. This, as far as a lot of scholars right now can tell, is one of the things that was really an innovation of the Buddhist system compared to some of the other systems that were around in South Asia at the time. This is not the same as the conception of karma and rebirth that appears in the, you know, in the sort of pre-Vedanta system that was arising in the Upanishads at the same time as the Buddha. It's not the same as the idea about what karma or action that has effects was in the Vedic system that preceded the Buddha. It seems to be a new vision of how action and its results works. And the core of the new vision is that it's ethical. Originally, so if you take the word karma, which just means action, if you take it back into the Vedic period, Vedic Sanskrit, in the Vedas, it really doesn't talk about ethics as much. It really talks about the proper performance of the sacred ritual and the chanting and the fire offering, the homa, the core of the Vedic ritual. And karma started meaning, if you do the ritual correctly and you pronounce the chants correctly, you do the sequence correctly, it will have the desired result of, you know, the message received, you know, reaching the gods, and which are mostly nature deities, you know, deities of storm and rain and sky and sun and water and wind. And, you know, one will be in right relationship with the ecosystem, in a way, with the cosmos. And so it has this sense of action done correctly has the, you know, gives rise to the desired result. The Buddha then spins that as he, in a funny way, the way he did in this argument with the Brahmin, he does a lot of this where he'll take a word and then he'll reinterpret it. You know, some of the core concepts in the Buddhist system seem to be words that had a certain usage in the Brahmanic and then before that in the Vedic system. And the Buddha reinterprets them, flips them around to mean something else. And so karma is one of those where it originally meant the proper performance of the ritual. The Buddha turns it into the proper performance of ethics. And so, like, there's a really beautiful sutta in the Digha Nikaya, the long discourses, called the Sigalika Sutta, where the Buddha comes upon a young man who is in the early mornings. The Buddha's out for alms round, comes upon this young man who is, his clothes are all wet, his hair is wet, so he's done the ritual bathing in the river, and he's making offerings to the six directions. And the Buddha says, "What are you doing?" And the kid says, "I'm doing the ritual of making offerings to the six directions, the way my parents taught me to do." And the Buddha says, "You're doing it wrong." And, you know, the kid is respectfully says, you know, "Please, Venerable, tell me how to do it." And the Buddha proceeds to reinterpret the old ritual of the six directions. So rather than saying, "Oh, you should offer this substance in this direction with this mantra, this substance in this direction with this mantra," the Buddha spins the teaching on the six directions into a teaching on ethical relationship. And so he says, "Your parents are this direction. Your teachers are this direction. Your kids are this direction. Your peers are this direction. Your elders are this direction. Your workers are this direction." And to each one, the ritual action is to care in an ethical way for the relationship. So to treat your parents with respect and take care of them, to treat your children with respect and take care of them. There's that, it's really the guidelines for maintaining ethical relationships. And so this weaves through the Buddha's vision, really at every level. And it goes all the way back to this insight that he has in his moment of awakening, that the thing that matters in how we are reborn is the ethical valence of our actions. So if you do things that are evil or harmful, it's going to go poorly, right? And it's going to go poorly in this life, maybe. The Buddha acknowledges that sometimes evil people have a lot of success in this life, but he says, "Don't worry, they'll get theirs." You know, they may be very successful and, you know, have a lot of money in this lifetime, but they're going to hell. Don't worry about it. You know, it's going to happen. Likewise, people can be really good, lovely folks, but they can have a really rough go in this lifetime, terrible oppression, nothing goes their way. The Buddha says, you know, "Don't worry about it. Their heart is pure. They're totally, you know, going to be reborn in a heaven realm." And of course, you know, heaven realms and hell realms are not the Christian model, right? They're all temporary. They're just more places you can be reborn. Eventually, the karma that landed you there runs out. You die from that lifetime and you're reborn somewhere else. You know, so you can land in a hungry ghost realm because you did something really terrible in one lifetime. But particularly if you get a little help from your descendants, often our ancestors are in the hungry ghost realm. The troubled ancestors are in the hungry ghost realm. The texts say you can give them some help by dedicating merit to them, sending them blessing. They can receive that, feel joyful, and then they almost immediately die from that realm and they're reborn in a more favorable existence. So the Buddha realizes that the thing that motivates perpetual return in this cycle is action. But good action, right, the thing that you should do, being ethical and all of that, good action can land you in a heaven realm, but it doesn't by itself liberate you entirely, right? Because you can get reborn in heaven, eventually you die from there. The sign that you're about to die from heaven is that you start to sweat. That's how beings know that that their extremely long lifespan in a heaven realm is almost over, is that they start to sweat and get hungry and they start to become slightly less beautiful. They start to lose their luster, and their fellow gods say, "Oh, you're about to die from this realm. You know, may you be, you know, born again in a blessed realm." You know. And so the Buddha realizes that ethical action will land you in a good place, a better rebirth, but it won't take you off the cycle altogether. And what he realizes is that the thing that keeps you on the wheel is that any action, whether very good or very evil, as long as there's still the quality of of craving, tanha, thirst, this is the second noble truth. As long as there's craving, there's dukkha. And so even if you're doing very good things, if you're doing those very good things, but there's a kind of wanting in your heart, let's say for a result, then there's craving present. And so you might be reborn in a heaven realm, but you're not going to get liberated based on that action. Something else is needed. And the something else that's needed is really seeing through or uprooting the defilements entirely. That's the third insight. So the Buddha's like, oh, if you uproot craving or wanting, that's different than doing good actions. That's like stepping out of good and evil altogether. When you do that, something else happens. And what happens is this thing that the Buddha would call amata, which is the deathless. And this is what he always said he was searching for. This is what he said he was preaching. After he became enlightened, he said, he was convinced to teach by Brahmasahampati, that there would be people who would understand his message. He said, you know, then I will go to teach. And he said, I go to Benares. He set out for the ancient sacred city of Varanasi first, which is where his friends were, his first students. He said, I go to Benares to beat the drum of the deathless. So here you are, endlessly reborn in the cycle of ethical action and its results. You do good, things go well. You do bad, things go worse. You're doing that since beginningless time, right? The Buddha says the amount of tears you've shed over the course of the eons is more than would fill the great oceans. You know, like we've just been doing this thing of struggling and despairing and having beautiful experiences and having terrible experiences for bloody ever in all these different kinds of life forms. You've been born as gods, you've been born as demons, you've been born as animals, you've been born as humans. And so however you take this, there's a vision of being, you know, like profoundly rooted in the cycle of coming and going in existence that just goes back forever. And it's sort of like, you're not like, I just turned 52. That's almost, it's nearly meaningless. This body is 52. But if I take on this idea, it's like, oh, but the momentum that I feel like is myself, you know, is nearly eternal, like has been just been going on and on and on and on. There's no conceivable beginning to it. There's no creator deity in this system, right? The universe just keeps expanding and contracting like a vast ecosystem. So when the Buddha becomes awakened by uprooting craving, uprooting the defilements, he attains what he calls the deathless. And then he says, I'm the eldest in the world because I was the first to do this. The word that for the deathless is amata. It means not dying. It's the Pali version of the very well-known Sanskrit word amrita, amrita, the ambrosia or the nectar of immortality, which in the Hindu imaginary, the gods and demons had a great battle over, where they churned an ocean of milk by placing the world mountain on the back of a turtle, Paul, at the bottom of that ocean, and they churned it using the snake that encircles the world, Adi Shesha, as the churning rope. And the gods were on one end pulling and the demons were on the other end. And as they churned the ocean of milk, all these extraordinary things came out, including the goddess Lakshmi herself, who Vishnu promptly married, wise. And then the nectar of immortality arose out of the churned milk. And the demons almost got it, but the gods tricked them, and the demons were too greedy and their minds were unclear, and the gods got it away from them. But like the amrita is, you know, is this deep concept, vision, mystery, you know, in the mythic imaginary of South Asia. And it shows up in these different ways. And very interestingly, right, in the Sanskrit texts, mostly under the influence of Vedanta, in which when one becomes enlightened, one realizes one's true self, which is indivisible from the divine self and is therefore immortal and full. That's essentially the same thing as the Buddha's enlightenment, where he realizes the absolute emptiness of the self, the not-self nature of things and calls it the deathless. But it's the same word, and it's virtually the same concept, as long as you understand that emptiness and fullness are not different, right? So that's the non-dual teaching at the heart of both of the traditions. But this thing, the deathless, then it becomes this beautiful mystery in the Buddha's description of himself. People would then ask him, you know, what happens to an enlightened one after death? What happens to a Buddha after death, physical death? And the Buddha said, it's not really an appropriate question. To say that the Buddha dies would be a way of saying that there was still something left that could cease to be. But awakening realizes that there's nothing here that could cease to be. The only thing that seems like it dies is an idea that I was a fixated identity. That idea was wrong. And so it's like saying, and this is the classic metaphor or simile, that, you know, it's like blowing out a flame. The flame of the candle burns in dependence on the fuel, right? Which is, you know, wax, let's say, and oxygen. And when the heat quality is separated from its fuel, the fire goes out. It's not appropriate to say that the fire died, although we use that kind of metaphorically. The fire died. You know, I have to relight it. But the fire itself is not a thing that can live or die. It's just a phenomenon that happens when these qualities come together, when heat and fuel come together. And so it's just as valid to say, you know, when a flame is blown out, that the flame is released, as if there's a fire quality in the universe, right? The old name would be Agni, the god Agni, that it's released from its fuel. And this is one of those places where the Buddha used the old Vedic and Brahmanic metaphors and repurposed them, where, you know, there was the idea of the three fires in the home that one had to keep lit all the time. And one would do fire offerings into these. So the Buddha spins this and says that, you know, the three fires are greed, hatred, and delusion. Right, the three things that keep one attached to the home, to the household life. These are the three fires of the home. It's the hearth, right, and the sacredness of the home fire. The Buddha says, and you get this beautiful layering of this kind of, you know, all of these similes coming together, the leaving of the home life to go into homelessness, and the uprooting of the defilements is the blowing out of the home fires, which is the definition of Nibbana. Nibbana means the extinguishing. So the Buddha blows out the home fires, disconnects heat from the life force of heat from its fuel. The fuel is craving for sights, sounds, smells, tastes, contact, experiences. When you cut craving off, there's nothing left that could be said to die. And so when the body dies, it's kind of like there was the body after awakening is just momentum. It's like there's a remainder left that's based on old karma, right? I have a living body because some people had craving, right? Two people who are very nice people had some lust 52 plus years ago. And here's a body that came out of that craving that they had. And God bless them, you know, here I am. It's great. And should I become fully enlightened in this lifetime? While I'm still alive, the body will continue after that moment for some time, as the Buddhas did for 45 years. And then the ending of the body, there's no conception that there was a being there that could die. There's just the recognition that this unfolding mystery gives rise to consciousness and, you know, and all of the beauties of being, but really death is no longer a meaningful concept. In that moment, the body simply continues to do what bodies do, which is that it arises and passes based on its connection with the elements. It's just a natural phenomenon. And so, so the Buddha arrives in the deathless. And in that sense, he was, in our era, the first one to attain that. And so he says, you know, I am the eldest. I take that to really mean I am the most senior of the elders, you know, the ones, because remember that whole story of the Brahmin, it began with Gotama doesn't honor his elders, doesn't honor the old people. And Gotama says, that's because I'm the oldest person. I'm the most senior realized person. And everyone else who gets realized after me, like all the arahants, all the monks who get, and nuns who get fully realized, they are junior to him in the monastic system, which is a seniority system. So then he's the eldest of the ones who should receive honor. So, all right, that was a little trippy. I'll pause there. May all the elders be venerated with appropriate honors, and may we attain elderhood in this lifetime or soon, as soon as possible, for the benefit of all beings.